Good afternoon from New York, and welcome to this NIAC Talks podcast, Dispelling Myths, International Arbitration in the United States and New York. Today, in episode 2, we look to the clashes of costs and cultures. My name is Rekha Rangachari, and I'm NIAC's Executive Director. We're delighted to offer different styles of programs during these strange times of pandemic, where we can discuss a variety of topics as our practice innovates and becomes in turn more flexible to new demands. We're fortunate to again have so many of you on the line from global jurisdictions. Eduardo, Jennifer, Ari, and I thank each of you for participating. We'll consider a handful of topics today, underscoring our theme, Dispelling Myths, about the United States, and in particular, New York. First, we look to costs, as it pertains to the cost to run hearings in New York, noting a pro-arbitration bench that regularly addresses enforcement, set-aside, and vacature proceedings, and the awarding of costs. Second, the clashes of cultures, to include a discussion where, for example, a contract is conceptualized and drafted under New York law models, and then, at the 11th hour, the governing law selected is one from a Latin American jurisdiction. What are the issues presented therein? Jennifer and Ari will share suggestions on how to best address this and key considerations. Allow me brief introductions of the speakers, known well to many of you. They are three leaders in our field. Professor Eduardo Zuleta is a principal at Zuleta Abogados Asociados and a member of NIAC's Global Advisory Board. Ari McKinnon is a partner at Cleary Gottlieb, Steen & Hamilton, and a NIAC director. And Jennifer Permsley is a partner at Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meeker & Flom, and a member of NIAC's Executive Committee. I also wish to thank our two supporting entities for co-sponsoring with us today, ALARP and the New York City Bar's Inter-American Affairs Committee. They each expand our access and reach for programs like this. In particular, my thanks go to Klaus von Bobeser, Maria Inez Cora, and Mike Fernandez. Two administrative items to all delegates. This session is being recorded, and please submit your questions within the WebEx portal. Time permitting, we may take these in real time as post. Now, on to our program in chief. Eduardo, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be back here with you and Jennifer and Ari on this podcast on dispelling myths, particularly in connection with having New York as a venue for international arbitration. One of the things that is normally discussed when looking for a seat in arbitration is, of course, the issue of costs. And the issue of costs would be twofold. On the one hand, the costs of the venue itself, paying for the facilities, traveling expenses, hotel expenses. And of course, there are a number of venues, particularly in Latin America nowadays, that are offering facilities for arbitration. And one of the myths there is that New York may be extremely expensive. That's one part of the issue of costs. And the second part of the issue of costs is whether there are certain rules under New York law or rules that would apply when New York is the seat that may affect the decision of the arbitrators when issuing an award or any decision on costs in the arbitration. So my first question to Ari and to Jennifer would be, what would be the advantage of having New York, despite, is number one, is it true the myth that New York is significantly more expensive than any other jurisdiction, particularly in Latin America, to be picked as a seat? And second, what you get when you pay for New York as a venue in general terms?
Thank you, Eduardo, and thanks to everybody who's here with us today and to NIAC as well. I think on the question of costs of the venue, New York tends to be, in my experience, somewhat more expensive than some of the alternative Latin American forums. really depends on the country. I mean, I've had arbitration seated in Lima, arbitration seated in La Paz, where I think the difference in costs is between New York and those forums is more significant. Arbitration seated in São Paulo, where maybe the difference is there, but it's not as meaningful between a New York and a São Paulo or a Rio. I think what we should all bear in mind on the question of costs of the venue, and that includes things, as you mentioned, Eduardo, like the costs of travel, but the costs of hotels and the costs of conference room space and support services for the arbitration hearing. My sense is you get what you pay for if you seek your arbitration in New York. Maybe I begin by saying, if you compare New York to some of the other international venues that you often see, such as a London or Paris, I don't see any difference in cost. I don't think New York is more expensive than those forums. In terms of getting what you pay for, I think in New York, obviously, you've got an abundance of hotel space, and you've got an abundance of conference room space to host your arbitrations. And you've got a number of professional organizations in New York, such as NIAC, that have deep experience in putting on arbitration hearings. You've also got excellent support services, you know, for example, court reporters, translation services here in New York that are excellent. So if you come to New York, you seat your arbitration in New York, what you're going to get is certainly excellent conference room space. So even if it is a bit more expensive, you'll have excellent conference room space. And as we come to rely more on technology to run our hearings, you know, even before the current COVID crisis, but certainly post COVID, we were relying more heavily on technology. New York's hearing venues have top-notch technology and connectivity, which you don't always get in other forums, especially in Latin America. I think the New York venue in that respect will certainly facilitate a seamless hearing experience. I think maybe most importantly as well, Eduardo, what you're getting in New York by seating your arbitration in New York is you're getting the services of the New York courts to supervise your arbitration. As we discussed during our last podcast, the New York courts have deep experience handling questions related to the enforcement of arbitration agreements, granting preliminary relief in aid of arbitration. And in addition, once you've got your arbitration award, the New York courts tend to be quite experienced in confirming and enforcing arbitration awards. So when you've got your arbitration award in hand, you've got something that's really, if it's been seated in New York, you've got something that's really worth the expense, right? Something that's in all likelihood going to be confirmed and is going to be enforceable. As far as the question of the second question, Eduardo, of awarding costs, I mean, as many of you know, the tradition in New York litigation is we don't have the loser pays rules. So traditionally, each side pays its own legal costs in U.S. and New York litigation. I would say in arbitration practice, most frequently, whether what rule will apply to the awarding of costs, it'll either be set out in the contract, or it'll be set out in the governing rules of the relevant arbitration or institution whose rules govern. And in my experience doing arbitrations in New York, certainly arbitrators are, where they're authorized to award costs, are comfortable doing so and will, in fact, award costs, even though, you know, the background New York litigation rule would not be to award costs. So in nearly all the arbitrations I do, in New York, we've either got an agreement of the parties that specifies that costs will be awardable, or we've got arbitral rules which permit the awarding of costs. And so there is a cost submission and an allocation of cost at the end of the day. Of course, in New York, you're free to contract out of that and to say that each party will bear its own costs. And we do see that sometimes.
I think you have a very good point in the issue of connectivity in that, regardless of this situation we are in now, the past experience, when you go to venues in countries that do not have good connectivity, particularly enough speed in the internet, web, et cetera, then you're paying less, but then the possibility of the hearing working well is substantially less. Jennifer, any additional comments, particularly on the awarding of costs? We see that there is a sense that an apparent clash between a tradition where the loser pays and the theory that each party has to bear its own costs. So is there any particular guidance that you can give our friends attending this as to what be the trend in an arbitration seated in New York, if any?
Yeah, I think it's very important, thanks Eduardo, to say something about it in the contract, probably no matter what governing law or seat you're putting in. I think it's a good idea. I think there's a false impression that arbitration institutions will govern this issue. And most arbitral institutions' rules say the arbitrator may award costs, you know, not must. If you have a New York seated and or a New York law governed contract, and you don't say anything more about your intentions with regard to cost, then it is, I do agree with Ari, the default will be that the parties did not expect a loser pays situation, that instead they expected that they would bear their own costs. And maybe that's not what they actually expected at all, but because you've chosen New York law or New York seat, the default is called the American rule, which is the parties bear their own costs. That will be, I would argue to the arbitrator, if it suited my client, that should be assumed to have been the presumption of the parties. And so the advice really at the drafting stage is to know that this would be the presumption and draft around it if you want to. And I think it's always a good idea to draft around it because you still can argue to the arbitrator whether or not they should actually impose a cost-shifting rule in the arbitration, but you give yourself the optionality by providing for it in the contract. The only other small thing I would say about costs is that, you know, when we were setting up NIAC many years ago as a hearing venue, which now really has become the premier hearing venue in New York for international arbitrations, we really looked and said, you know, what are we going to charge for this hearing space? Actually, hearing space is such a small portion of the overall cost of an arbitration. The main cost of an arbitration come in the arbitral institution's fees, the arbitrator's fees, and of course the lawyer's fees. And choosing those things is really more centered on the international nature of your contract, you know, whether you believe you need an internationalized institution or counsel outside of your own jurisdiction to handle the dispute because of its very nature. I would caution against automatically using a Latin American arbitral institution for a cross-border dispute, because I think you get a lot of limitations there in the choice of arbitrators, the arbitrator pool that's available, and in the sophistication of the administering institution to handle, you know, a cross-border dispute. But that's really where you're making your decisions about whether it's worth the extra expense in the institution and, you know, the type of counsel you'll need in order to litigate that dispute. And the hearing venue and the travel to get the hearing done, it becomes really a very secondary cost once it comes time, you know, for an actual dispute.
Thanks. One of the things that we, that the three of us have discussed and sometimes laughed about is what is known in this clash of cultures that we're discussing as the Frankenstein contracts. And when I refer to the Frankenstein contracts, it's the typical contract that is drafted based on the New York law model for an M&A transaction, for a project finance, or even a collateral pledge or the similar, sometimes framework agreements for a huge transaction. And the parties negotiate the entire agreement based on a New York model. And then at the very last minute, shortly before the closing, one of the parties, the Latin American party, says, well, this has to be governed by Bolivian law, by Colombian law, by Paraguayan law. And then the parties that have already agreed on all the terms and conditions of the agreement that are that want to close the deal, yes or yes, they accept that. And then when it goes to the arbitration, you have a model contract that contains a number of clauses on subjects such as reps and warranties, damages, penalties, lost profits, entire agreement clauses, force majeure clauses, and the like, that are normally and widely known under New York law, but then the governing law is a law that is totally alien to the contract. It's a Latin American law, it's civil law, it's codified law. So what has been your experience in those type of contracts? The first question is how to avoid that when you're drafting the contract. And second, what has been your experience? And we're going to go over several of the issues that I have mentioned, loss of profits, reps and warranties, liquidated damages, et cetera. But what would be the advice first on the drafting of those clauses on the and number two, what has been your experience in arbitrations involving this Frankenstein agreements?
Thanks, Eduardo. I'll start us off on this one. I know we all have a lot of different thoughts, so I wanted to start us off with just sort of a general concept that may be familiar to a lot of people on the phone. You know, the typical, let's say, M&A agreement has really become internationalized in a way that there are clauses that you see in every single agreement, and they are, you know, very likely derived from New York law governed, or maybe in some instances, UK law governed M&A agreements, and just imported, you know, globally. And so what's important to understand about that is that the way that some of those clauses are phrased and the words that are used or chosen that are, you know, sometimes really copy and pasted from one agreement to another have developed in the way that they have because New York law and the U.S. Delaware law also contributes a lot to M&A law have already defined in the common law and the case law precedents what those terms mean, what is the context for what we're providing. So something like, you know, materiality or material adverse effect, which is becoming, you know, a big deal in the COVID environment, may not necessarily be spelled out in great detail in the contract. It may be, but may not be. In which case, an entire very thorough body of precedent, of case law precedent, defines what it means. Not only defines what it means, but also gives examples of cases in which the party is successful or not successful. And so when you choose New York law to govern, you're getting the entire benefit of that body of law, which will enable you to rely upon it in arguing your position later down the road. If you instead choose a law of another jurisdiction where those precedents did not grow up and where there's not a ton of law, you're really losing a lot of that context, and in some cases maybe importing instead civil law principles or extraneous to the contract principles that govern in those jurisdictions that no one really thought through or knew applied. So, you know, what can you do to prevent against it? Well, you can think about it early and, you know, choose to redraft your contract a little bit in order to provide for whatever the governing law you've chosen rather than change it at the last minute. But maybe more easily done, because we do have the standard provisions that we use over and over again, is to think about being as specific as possible in the contract rather than allowing these terms to be defined by any one particular jurisdiction's law. We know that pacta sunt servanda is a very, you know, key principle in all of Latin America. And so I do think it's fairly common for the courts to try to enforce what the parties meant. And by not leaving those terms to chance, by defining them or being very specific about what would be the threshold for materiality in your contract, or, you know, another example is what knowledge is attributable to a seller? Does it have to be high levels of management, or can you attribute the knowledge of lower level employees who maybe knew about something like corruption or bribery when management didn't? Those are concepts that New York law has case law to help guide. If you're not going to govern it by New York law, you may actually need to put in a list of, you know, who are the persons within the seller who are assumed to be attributed knowledge for the purpose of a breach of rep and warranty. So those sorts of things can be just made more explicit in the contract if you believe that you're going to change the governing law and not rely on the body of precedent that already exists. So that would be my starting comment.
Okay, thank you. Ari, without prejudice of your commenting on what Jennifer just said, but one of the things that one sees in every single agreement that is governed under New York law is the issue of reps and warranties. And as we discussed in our prior conversations, This issue of the reps and warranties, if you apply a Latin American law, whatever that is, of a civil law, then you will go into a discussion as to whether there needs to be, for a breach of a representation and warranty, whether that is an issue of bad faith, dolo, whether as the reps and warranties refer to the costs of the contract, and then if a breach of a rep and warranty could mean that the costs that what caused the party to enter into a contract was not complied with, that there is no consent. There are a number of theories, if you apply Latin American law to that concept of the reps and warranties, which I understand, I'm not a New York lawyer, has a very specific meaning when you insert that in a contract. So I would like you to comment on that clash that results when you include reps and warranties traditional in a New York law frame contract, and then you attempt to apply a civil law to that.
Yeah, thanks very much, Eduardo, for the question. And maybe just to start responding to what Jennifer mentioned, I completely agree. I mean, I think the best way to avoid this situation, which I'm going to delve into in a little bit more detail about reps and warranties in a moment, is to try to agree upon governing law earlier on in the negotiation process. But as we discussed, Eduardo, unfortunately, you know, during our first podcast, it's frequently the case that the corporate lawyers come to us to discuss the governing law and dispute resolution clauses after the deal has been agreed at the 11th hour. And when there doesn't seem to be much room to negotiate or to insist upon a governing law that is consistent with the contract. So I think there, you may be a change in practice and really a focus on governing law earlier on is the best we can do to avoid this Frankenstein situation. On the question of reps and warranties, I've had a number of cases, Eduardo, presenting the situation that you've identified. And I think part of it has to do with what Jennifer was mentioning, that to some extent, international practice is becoming more standardized. I mean, I think you see that in a lot of different fields. It seems like the world is becoming more and more one place. When we travel the globe, it feels like we leave New York and we arrived in Bogota, and there's the same sort of restaurants and the like. And I think we're seeing a similar phenomenon to some extent with M&A agreements, where there are forms and models that are coming to be used. I think, as Jennifer mentioned, a number of those models often use UK or New York law as a starting point, and you get a bunch of reps and warranties as a result, because that's typical of our practice in the common law jurisdictions. I've got a case right now that involves an M&A agreement, which was clearly drafted with US style reps and warranties in mind, but at the end of the day, the governing law was decided to be a Brazilian law. And as happens with many M&A agreements, unfortunately, we're now embroiled in a dispute about, in fact, an international arbitration about how to understand and interpret these representations and warranties. As is typical, you know, the contract in this case, and you'll see this in many contracts that have reps and warranties, provides for indemnification, the payment of damages in essence, but indemnification in the event that there's a breach of the reps and warranties. And in the US and the UK, this is not at all unusual, right? There's a deep body of jurisprudence, as Jennifer was mentioning, that if you've got a New York law governed contract, you'll be able to take advantage of, which interprets these sorts of clauses, these reps and warranties, and requires the payment of losses caused by breaches of the reps and warranties. As you mentioned, Eduardo, in many Latin American jurisdictions, including Brazil, there's not as much of a history of the use of representations and warranties. So the question arises how to conceptualize a claim for breach of reps and warranties under Brazilian law or under the law of whatever civil law governed country we're talking about. You know, is it a claim for breach of contract? If so, what is the specific action that the breaching party took or failed to take, which constitutes a breach of contract? You know, claims for breaches of reps and warranties don't fit neatly necessarily within the the civil codes kind of conceptualization of breaches of contracts. If it's not a breach of contract, then I guess the question arises, is it a claim for dolo, you know, for fraud? And if it's a claim for fraud, as you mentioned, Eduardo, is then proof of scienter required? In other words, for proof of knowledge that the statement was or the rep was false. That, you know, as we know, I mean, one of the purposes of reps and warranties in US, UK common law practice is precisely to throw upon the party that's making the reps and warranties the responsibility for the truth of those reps and warranties, regardless of whether the party knew that they were false. You know, in other words, they're a way of shifting contractually the responsibility for certain risks. So if you require scienter, if you conceptualize of a breach of reps and warranties as a claim for dolo under the civil code, in some ways you're kind of eliminating the very purpose of the reps and warranties. So that's, you know, an important issue and an important question that arises. And I think finally, in the context of reps and warranties, another issue is, as you mentioned, Eduardo, what's the remedy? If it's a case of, you know, dolo principal that really vitiates the consent of the contracting parties, and we're taking a strict civil law, a civil code perspective, does that mean the contract is null and void? Or can damages be brought because it's more of a case of dolo incidental under the relevant provisions of the civil code, which would be the case in the U.S. You know, my experience has been in larger jurisdictions in Latin America, like Brazil, there is enough of a practice of using reps and warranties. It's become, you know, commonplace enough that there's an emerging body of jurisdiction in Brazil, which to my mind is taking sort of a common sense approach, not an overly formalistic approach to reps and warranties, and has tried to give them meaning, which to my mind is not all that different from what the final result might be in a US or UK governed dispute. But if you go to other jurisdictions, other civil law jurisdictions, where maybe there's a little bit less in the way of large M&A transactions, a little bit, maybe there are fewer of these large international M&A deals with reps and warranties, I don't think you'll find that there's all that much jurisprudence telling you what the right answer is on all those questions I've identified. And you could wind up in a very complicated situation when you've got a dispute, an international arbitration over whether, you know, you're just going to kind of ignore the governing law and try to give these the effect that they would have in the US or the UK, or you're going to try to shoehorn the concept of reps and warranties into some figure or concept under the civil code, whether it's breach of contract, dolo incidental or dolo principal. So I mean, I think the basic bottom line takeaways need to be very careful when negotiating these issues, especially need to understand if there's some sort of compromise at the end of the day and you're thinking about adding a civil law, you know, as the governing law at the 11th hour, some thought needs to be given to what does that particular jurisdiction's law say, if anything, about reps and warranties.
You mentioned a very important point, that there's a trend in Latin American lawyers to trying to find the legal nature of things. And the legal nature of things means the need to find in the written law, in the codified law, what is the contract or the form or the clause that resembles or which is more similar to the one that you have in the agreement. Another issue that we've seen and that we have discussed, and I would like Jennifer to comment on that. Most of the contracts that you have under New York law contain a provision along the following lines: this contract contains the entire contract and understanding between the parties, and supersedes all prior negotiations, representations, undertakings, and agreements on any subject matter, et cetera, et cetera. But then you find under most civil laws, the rule under which it goes by saying, basically, when the intent of the parties is clear, then the judge must state to it and not to the literal sense of the wording. So then you have a sort of a clash. On the one hand, you have a clause that is saying, well, the contract is the contract, you have the wording there, and you have to abide by it. And then probably the other party would be claiming, well, this is Bolivian law, this is Brazilian law, this is Colombian law, and then you have to go to the intent of the parties, and you cannot simply disregard all the negotiations, the drafting, et cetera. What to do in a case like that?
Yeah, so I don't know if I'm going to have the what to do answer. I do think it's a problem. This actually goes to an entire cultural difference in the way we view contracts and the evidence that can come in to either vary the terms or inform the terms of what the parties intended in the contract. The entire agreement or integration clause, as it's sometimes called, that you find in almost all New York law governed agreements generally, including M&A agreements, is really a codification of a rule that says, four corners of the contract is what governs. All of the evidence outside of the contract that might tell you what the contract was intended to mean is irrelevant and won't be looked at by a court unless there's a circumstance which demands it, a very obvious ambiguity where it's not clear what the intention of the parties was or some, but you have to prove that first. So that is not the automatic presumption. And people are very worried, always very fearful of discovery, in US style arbitrations or US courts. But in a sense, you have a very important backstop on the discovery principle, which is that the courts will be very firm about not considering the extrinsic evidence if they don't think the contract allows them to do so. And that entire agreement clause is one aspect that they look at, saying we're actually not allowed to go outside of this contract. So I don't care what was exchanged in discovery. I'm going to look at what it says. In Latin American jurisdictions, in fact, in most other jurisdictions in the world, the evidence of what the parties intended is key, is critical. And, even though disclosure might be very limited in those jurisdictions, a judge will consider it very relevant to look at things that fall outside the contract. Why this is so important is that if you've been negotiating an agreement, thinking it was going to be governed by New York law or sort of within the framework of a U.S. Cultural, framework, you're maybe having your conduct in such a way that believe that ultimately what you agree to, the words in the contract you agree to, will be what matters at the end of the day. And so you might be very open and willing to have, free-flowing communications and negotiations, believing that the ultimate decision of what to include in the contract at the end of the day will be what governs. Whereas if you then import Latin American, law into the contract, all of a sudden all of those communications become possibly, free reign for a judge or for an opponent to bring in. I think that this goes back to what we started with, which is what to be done in this situation. The parties in the drafting stage need to be aware of many times corporate lawyers have not seen enough different litigations or arbitrations to really be aware of how these issues come up or affect things. So they need to really be aware in the drafting stage that, the choice of law will matter not only for the substantive protections, but also potentially for some of these procedural aspects that will weigh in. And international arbitrators, I think, have to really think about whether they should look at this entire agreement clause and enforce the contract in the way that a New York court might or U.S. court might, saying, we're not going to look at anything outside, or whether because international arbitration was chosen, have the parties now assumed a more internationalized process in which, even though disclosure and arbitration is generally more limited than the U.S., it might encompass things like negotiations surrounding the contract, and the arbitrator might be able to consider those things. I wrote an article a few years ago about whether governing law even really matters in international arbitration, because in some ways, I think arbitrators in a very internationalized context think of themselves as internationalists, as truth finders, and as decision makers. And that means importing in understandings and principles from different jurisdictions in order to inform how they read a contract. And at the end of the day, the governing law in an arbitration might actually be somewhat less important than the governing law would be in any court system, because an arbitrator believes themselves capable of reading the language in the contract, understanding the different international cultural contexts that might have been, you know, had by the parties as they were negotiating, and using all of these things to inform what is the just or right decision at the end of the day. Whether or not that's actually a good thing, or even legal, or results in a fully enforceable award is another topic altogether. I think one that Eduardo is very interested in. We can go into that. But I do think that it's a fact that international arbitrators maybe give less credence to the governing law than a jurist in a certain jurisdiction would, in an effort to harmonize all of the different perspectives that the parties would have had when they came into the negotiating forum.
Yeah, you make a very good point on the approach of the New York courts to that particular clause. I saw an interesting debate in some time ago on this clash. And one of the claims that was made was, okay, yeah, there is a provision under this applicable civil law to the effect that when the intent of the parties is clear, the judge must go to it and not to the literal words, but that is an interpretative provision, and the parties, by including the integration clause, waived that interpretative provision and mandated the arbitrators to interpret the contract the way it is, period. That was an interesting way to look at the thing. And of course, the debate there is whether this provision that the judge has to go to the intent of the parties is or not a mandatory provision under the applicable law. Another issue that arises in this conflict or in this clashes is because or results from the difference in the approach to the damages. In civil law tradition, you have the so-called the direct damages, and you have the loss of profits, lucro cesante in Spanish. And there are a number of assumptions that lucro cesante is the same as loss of profits, which I understand is not the same. That liquidated damages is the equivalent of penalties, which I understand is not the same. And then, again, there is a problem when you have this sort of concept of damages based on a draft that was prepared with New York law in mind. And then you have Latin American law applied to that with concepts that exist in civil law jurisdictions, but they have apparently totally different meaning. If you want to comment to us on that point.
Yeah, no, I'd be happy to do that, Eduardo. And I think this is an issue that comes up a lot in our arbitrations. You know, maybe I can start with the easiest or most obvious conflict or potential clash that I see, which is on the specific issue of liquidated damages under New York law. You know, under New York law, it's interesting because, you know, a lot of times I think of New York as being extremely, you know, pro autonomy of the parties and extremely respectful of the agreement that the parties have reached. But on the specific issue of liquidated damages, there has grown up a whole body of jurisprudence in New York and in most of the common law jurisdictions, that liquidated damages are not enforceable. They cannot be enforced if they're a penalty. And so liquidated damages can be enforceable. First of all, it must be difficult ex ante to estimate the damages or to value damages. So there must be difficulty in calculating damages. And also the liquidated damages to be enforceable must be a reasonable estimate of the actual damages suffered. Otherwise, liquidated damages clauses will not be enforced. And one of the surest ways to get your liquidated damages clause thrown out and not enforced in New York is to call it a penalty. Although when you see some contracts that have been, you know, drafted with the civil law in mind, sometimes you'll even see clauses that are called, you know, like penalidades or penalties. And you know, even if you put that title on a clause in New York law, even if your liquidated damages that follow are well thought out, you've already put yourself in a danger zone. I mean, I think part of the reason that liquidated damages are looked at somewhat suspiciously in New York and why they have to be justified, why they have to be reasonable, is that New York courts, like the courts of many common law jurisdictions, they subscribe to a theory that has come to be known, or was known when I was in law school many years ago, as, you know, a theory of efficient breach. Basically means that if you're in a situation where it's more efficient for a party to breach the contract and to pay the actual damages, because that party will make more money elsewhere, the law wants to encourage that activity, or at least it does not want to discourage that activity. And if you have liquidated damages or penalties that are enforced and are very large, you might be discouraging what could be efficient or productive conduct for society. In other words, breaching the contract and going to do something else that would allow you to make more money. So that's an obvious area of potential conflict, and one where I think parties need to take great care, because liquidated damages or penalidades are a feature of a lot of the contracts we see, for example, in the contract in the construction space, the infrastructure space, even to some extent in oil and gas and mining contracts. On the other question you raised, the lost profits, this is really interesting, because what I see is a lot of contracts these days will exclude, or they'll include a clause that purports to exclude indirect damages. Right. Sometimes they'll say indirect damages, including lost profits. There's a whole interesting set of New York law that is kind of developing around the concept of whether lost profits are direct or they're indirect damages. So there's a debate, and actually some New York courts have held that in certain instances, lost profits that clearly arise directly under, or arise under the very same contract you're talking about, they can be direct damage. So you have to be careful when you're thinking about applying New York law. If you've got an exclusion for indirect damages, that doesn't necessarily mean that lost profits are unrecoverable. They may be recoverable if they're deemed to arise sort of directly under the contract at issue. The other thing, and here I think practically there's not a huge difference, but conceptually there is somewhat of a difference. You'll see in a number of civil law jurisdictions that the civil code will provide for the kind of full compensation, including, as you were saying, Eduardo, lucro cesante or lost profits. So the civil code does in many jurisdictions contemplate or include the principle of full compensation for losses. In the U.S., generally speaking, unless there's in New York, unless there's a exception in the contract, an exclusion of lost profits or indirect damages, what you get are your expectancy damages, what you were expected to get under the contract, which often can include lost profits, but there's a carve out where those, or you cannot get lost profits where they're speculative, or there isn't really sufficient evidence to make the decision maker comfortable that he or she can calculate and estimate the damages. I think at the end of the day, you wind up getting to a similar place, if not the very same place, based on background principles of, you know, in the U.S., New York, and the civil law jurisdictions that expressly provide for full compensation. But at the margins, there can certainly be differences under New York law and under civil law jurisdictions as far as the recoverability of lost profits, including specifically if those lost profits don't seem to be easy to estimate or easy to calculate.
One question that arises in connection with the issue of damages, for either one of you to refer to that, is one sees quite often an exclusion of punitive damages. Is that something that is allowed under New York law, and specifically could an arbitral tribunal in the absence of that exclusion grant punitive damages to a party?
So this is an interesting question under New York law. You know, what if the contract doesn't say anything at all about whether punitive damages are allowed? Are they allowed then, or are they not allowed? The default rule in New York for many years was that arbitrators could not award punitive damages. Why, right? But why is that not something that's left to the freedom of the arbitrators? Well, the idea was because punitives are really meant to right a public wrong, you know, make the party that has done a sort of harm that we do not want society to have to feel pay for that. So they're punishment in measure. They're not compensatory in their nature. The Supreme Court in the U.S. In an arbitration decision actually said that New York rule that it's against public policy for an arbitrator to issue punitive damages. No way. If the parties want to exclude the possibility of punitive damages, then they should say so in their contract, and they're welcome to. But if they don't, then, you know, the arbitrator is free to award whatever type of remedy it sees fit. Now, and a few years later, a New York appellate court followed that decision, as it's bound to do. It's a Supreme Court decision, and basically said this is no longer the rule in New York. Arbitrators are free to award punitive damages. I think parties in other jurisdictions are really concerned about that. You know, is that really the case that you know, a New York law governed dispute can all of a sudden result in punitives? And do I need to think about excluding it in my drafting in order to avoid that possibility? And the answer is yes. If you do want to avoid the possibility, you should think about expressly excluding it in your drafting. We don't do it that often. It's not something that I commonly add to an arbitration clause. And the reason is really because there are so few substantive legal areas in U.S. law that allow punitives anyway, that it's very unlikely that it's going to come up in an arbitration, because you still need to argue to the arbitrator that there's a basis for punitives. And in most commercial contracts, the damages rules are that the damages need to be compensatory. You know, you may not even be able to get indirect or consequential losses, depending on how your contract's set up, let alone just imposing a punishment on the other side. It's very uncommon for arbitrators to find that they have the authority to do that. It would need to be either in some sort of statutory principle that you're bringing into the arbitration, or very clearly codified in the law that's developed that's specific to the dispute you have at hand. So it's not, I guess the answer is it's not something to be worried about generally as affecting your New York seated or New York law governed arbitration. But it is something that if you believe that you're entering into the type of transaction where there could be an argument that a punishment or a punitive damage should be rendered against you, then you should think about it specifically excluding the arbitrator's ability to do that, because the default rule in the U.S. now is that if it doesn't say anything in the contract, there is that authority. It does exist in certain circumstances. I think there's an article that finds that, like, there's no ICC case that's ever awarded punitive damages in a commercial contract situation. So it really isn't something that we need to be extremely worried about, but I'm telling you, you know, what the law currently says.
Another area that we've seen debates and clashes of cultures when you have this sort of mixture of applicable law in the agreement, an agreement drafted on the one model and then following a different legal system or legal tradition, is the issue of force majeure. Force majeure, you see the definitions of force majeure in the contracts drafted under New York law, very detailed and long definitions of what force majeure is, what are the circumstances that constitute force majeure, what are the effects of force majeure. But then you go to the civil law that is applicable to the contract, and then you find a general definition of, well, force majeure being something that is unforeseeable, unpredictable, that is not within the control of the party, et cetera. And normally you see a clash between what is force majeure under the applicable law and what you have defined as force majeure in the contract. Have you seen that, Jennifer? And can you comment on that?
So, we're obviously seeing a lot of force majeure arguments popping up now. What's interesting, I think, about them under the difference between New York and many different Latin American jurisdictions is that the extra contractual theories that will be available under New York law are very, very limited. They're extremely hard to justify that you have the circumstances that warrant them. And for the most part, what you say in the contract will be what matters. And we know that contracts actually have somewhat different language on force majeure or material adverse effect, which is often the same thing. Clauses, you know, some of them specifically exclude pandemics, some of them specifically include pandemics, acts of God. So it's an interesting area. But in the U.S., what you say in the language of the contract is pretty much what you're going to be stuck with some limited extra contractual exceptions. In Latin America, many jurisdictions, depending on the legal tradition which they follow, may have many extra contractual mechanisms for allowing parties to get out of a contract based on unforeseen circumstances. The theory of improvisación, for example, would basically allow a party to say that the economics have changed so drastically that they no longer should be bound by their contract. That's a powerful ability for a party. That's something that would not normally be seen in U.S. That's buyer beware, and buyer sort of suffers the consequences, regardless of whether it's economically palatable. And that might be a very common, and because it's extra contractual, it will apply. If you've imported a law of Latin American jurisdiction that follows that theory, it's considered, you know, almost mandatory in nature in terms of the law allows it because it needs to protect parties. It's a protective mechanism. Whereas in the U.S., what you say in the contract, you're presumed to have agreed to and be sophisticated, and that's it. This is, I think, an area where it's most stark that an arbitrator who decides to be sort of internationalist, or, you know, think of the contract from the law that was really intended, everybody knew it was supposed to be New York law, even though they said Chilean law, would get themselves in the most trouble. Because if you decided to ignore or not apply, you know, a mandatory or extra contractual principle of this sort of protectionist nature that would apply in Latin America, you might, you know, be accused of, as we say in the U.S., manifestly disregarding the law that was supposed to have applied to the contract, and or, you know, have your award not enforced as a matter of public policy because of the nature of these types of principles in Latin America. They rise to the level where you might get pretty close to a public policy violation. So this is an area where what we were saying before about approaching it from an internationalist perspective might actually be a dangerous or illegal thing for an arbitrator to do, depending on the circumstances.
Ari, your views on that point. I have a question from what Jennifer said, an interesting question for both of you. But if you want to have any additional comments on what Jennifer just said.
Yeah, no, I agree completely with what Jennifer said. I think this is an area, and it's really fresh in all of our minds because of COVID, where we see a marked difference in background legal principles, the issue of force majeure, an area where you're not going to have any force majeure protection in the U.S. Unless you've specifically contracted for it in your contract, and that the result will obviously be different. In nearly all Latin American jurisdictions. I wanted to mention there's a question from the audience that I see was directed to me that I missed while I was speaking, which is, you know, just the question on whether under New York law you have a recital in your contract that the parties agree damages are difficult to estimate and that the liquidated damages are the party's best estimate of the damages, that in essence you would insulate the clause from being challenged by a party. I think that's certainly very good practice. And I think if you're in a situation where it is difficult to ascertain damages, that will go a long way to, you know, making your clause enforceable in New York. There is, you know, like there is the ex ante question. There's the question of whether, given your specific contract, damages are really, in fact, difficult to ascertain. And there are certain contracts providing, for example, for the payment of a sum certain on a regular basis, where it may not be possible to make the argument that that damages are difficult to ascertain, and where you're probably, regardless of the language that you put in your recitation in the New York law governed contract, you're probably not going to be able to enforce a penalty. And the New York courts have really underlined that, because I think they've held that a contract that allows a party the option of pursuing liquidated damages or actual damages is not enforceable, because that suggests that you didn't need the liquidated damages in the first place, because actual damages could be ascertained. So really when, you know, thinking about liquidated damages under New York law, it really is quite important to bear in mind that first consideration that you need to have a situation where damages are difficult to ascertain. If they're not difficult, it doesn't matter how reasonable your estimate is or whether the parties have agreed to its reasonableness, you're going to have an enforceability problem.
Yeah, that's interesting because in a number of Latin American jurisdictions, you can validly have the option of having a quote-unquote penalty clause that may have the nature of anticipated damages. And you can agree, well, these are the damages that we estimate as anticipated damages, and the party under the general rule of a number of Latin American jurisdictions could only collect that amount, and it would not be allowed in certain cases to claim that the damages were more or less, but that's it, that's what the parties agreed, or you can agree to those damages as a penalty. So what you're saying about that, the way it would work under New York law is very interesting because there's a clear clash and difference there. But my question, the question that I mentioned for both of you is, could an arbitrator or a tribunal under New York law decide, for example, that given that the contract was prepared under following a New York law model and to some extent reflects what the parties had in mind, but then under Latin American law was applied according to the applicable law provision, then could the arbitrators say something like, okay, I'm going to see what the common principles are between New York law, which is what the parties have in mind, and the applicable Latin American law, and build something along the lines of common principles of both the traditions of both civil law and New York law jurisdictions, or something along the lines of, okay, I'm going to apply, I don't know, unidroit principles that are common to both New York law and Bolivian law or Paraguayan law. Could an arbitrator do that? But more than that, of course, an arbitrator could do whatever. But the question is, if the tribunal goes that way and applies common principles to New York law and the applicable civil law or unidroit principles to try to consolidate the agreement of the parties, would a New York court enforce that award? Would a New York court have a problem with that award?
I'd be happy to jump in on that question. I think, you know, as we discussed during our first podcast, the New York courts have not historically applied the doctrine of manifest disregard with any frequency to international arbitrations. It tends to be a doctrine that's been limited to domestic arbitrations, local law, U.S. law governed arbitrations, for example, and U.S. seated arbitrations, where an arbitrator has allegedly just manifestly disregarded the law. I would say, though, that in theory, manifest disregard is available for international arbitrations. And if an arbitrator were to say something like, I recognize that Bolivian law requires the following or provides the following, and then were to proceed to expressly disregard what Bolivian law required, and to try to craft a remedy out of, combining different legal systems or going to universal legal principles, that would give rise, I think, to at least a colorable argument of manifest disregard. What I tend to see, Eduardo, in practice is I see the arbitrator struggling with what Bolivian law requires, given that there's a Frankenstein clause in front of the arbitrators, and then using other laws to try to help the arbitrator interpret Bolivian law, but still sticking with we're trying to interpret Bolivian law and give the parties agreement meaning. If that is what the arbitrators do, I think it would be much more difficult for a manifest disregard challenge to have any success.
Yeah, Jennifer, I would like to hear your views on that issue because it's very frequent for that to occur. That sort of debate amongst the arbitrators, should we try to build on common principles here, try to do something, or simply, this is Bolivian law applies, end of the story?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I said in the first podcast that I do think there are some circumstances where manifest disregard plays a role in serving as a backstop as to what you really can't do. And so in some ways, you know, the arbitrators need to be clever about it if they are deciding to use international principles that would not precisely align with the governing law of the contract. It's also hard for parties to argue what we really meant was New York law, you know, even though we said Bolivian. I mean, you're going to put yourself in a difficult situation if that's what you need to argue later on. And so I do think that we're stepping into dangerous territory when we talk about this. I do think the governing law continues to be important, and there might be an enforceability problem if the arbitrators go too far in using an internationalist model that really precisely doesn't align with the governing law. And I think this is really the key point, because many internationalist, you know, generalized principles already align with the laws of many jurisdictions in more ways than they do not align. And we have a comment in the chat from Fred Fucci that where you really need to be careful, where the rubber really hits the road is something a mandatory law in a civil jurisdiction such that you're ignoring it in a blatant way that is going to possibly give rise to something like a public policy enforcement challenge. If we're not there, if we're basically towing the line between the international understanding of what a contract provision means and the very specific, you know, Chilean or Argentine law requirement that might be, you know, going slightly to the left, but not, you know, too far off, then we're probably okay in thinking about the contract from a more generalized internationalist, common sense language of the contract perspective, rather than slavishly following the law of any jurisdiction, including whether that be, you know, New York itself. So I think that arbitrators, if you choose the right ones, are sophisticated enough to know what to do with these issues, but they should be careful of the situations in which there's a mandatory law component at play.
Yeah, there's an interesting issue there in the comments that I'm seeing in the chat, because normally what you will find in a civil law tradition are basically three types of legal provisions. One that applies mandatorily and that the parties cannot derogate from. The second are the clauses that are deemed to be included in any contract unless the parties exclude them. And then the provisions that are not included in a contract unless the parties include them. And what I'm seeing here is the issue of imprevision on the one hand, hardship. I think imprevision and hardship are slightly different, but and then force majeure. That in some jurisdictions may be a matter of public policy, mandatory. In other jurisdictions, it would be a matter of those clauses being considered as or being deemed as included in the contract unless you expressly exclude that. So. If I go back to Jennifer's comment in the beginning, you would have to, if at the very last minute you include a Latin American law as the law applicable to the contract, you would have to go back and look at least to this. By including a Latin American law, am I including additional clauses that I don't want to have in the contract? Or am I violating any public policy provision of the applicable law? What has been your experience with those provisions that are unexpected, mandatory, and that are included at the very last minute? What sort of problems could that create in going back to these questions that are in the chat?
I think in addition to a number of the issues that we discussed, one of the issues that comes repeatedly in my practice is the issue of good faith. And what is the content of the duty of good faith? And I don't want to overly generalize, but my experience has been that when you import a Latin American law or any civil law to a contract at the very last minute, you import oftentimes a more substantive and more biting duty of good faith than you might get under New York law. That's a gross generalization. It's not always true, but I'm thinking about a number that I've done in Peru and one presently in Brazil, where the duty of good faith has you know, in a number of civil law jurisdictions, a little bit more bite to it in terms of including a duty to inform, you know, during the negotiation process, a duty to inform that might be kind of surprising to U.S. Practitioners. And it has a little bit more bite to it, even in the performance of the contract. New York law has oftentimes is very much circumscribed and limited the instances in which you can make a claim for breach of the implied duty of good faith. And certainly the claim is there. And I know it's tough to make both oftentimes in the U.S. and in Latin American jurisdictions. But that's another area where I think a lot of attention needs to be paid. That by bringing in a Latin American law at the end, you are bringing in the civil code's definition of good faith, both pre-contractual and during the performance of the contract. And you need to have an understanding of what that means practically.
Okay, and this pre-contractual, and I go back to the comment that Jennifer made on the integration clause, because Ari has raised a very interesting point. This pre-contractual arrangements can be taken either as part of the interpretation of the contract or the pre-contractual stage as a breach of a duty to inform, a breach of a duty to negotiate in good faith. What would be the consequence of that? Those rules would apply if a Latin American law applies, but how would an arbitrator react to that if in the circumstances that we're considering? In other words, the integration clause on the one hand, and on the other hand, a provision that says, well, you have to look at the pre-negotiation stage, whether the parties negotiated in good faith, et cetera.
Yeah, I could see the arbitrator trying to, and of course, it completely depends on the factual circumstances of the case, but I think it would be very difficult to import a Latin American law at the end and then to say, there's no pre-contractual, you know, duty of good faith. So the arbitrators cannot look at the pre-contractual negotiation history in order to evaluate a separate claim for breach of the duty of good faith. It seems like that's one of the principles that by selecting the civil law, the relevant civil law to govern, you are going to open yourself up to a pre-contractual claim for breach of the duty of you know, good faith. On the other hand, in terms of interpreting the contract itself, the contractual claim, very difficult to know how it would come up, but I could see trying to say that in terms of the contractual claim itself, maybe trying to respect the integration clause and the fact that the parties really wanted the arbitrator to focus on the language of the contract and just this contract in interpreting claims for breach of the contract as opposed to claims for breach of the duty of good faith. That's kind of like a Solomonic resolution and not sure what would happen in every case in practice, but I could see the argument for trying to thread that needle.
To conclude this, and going back to what we discussed at the very beginning, there is of course always the myth, the idea that corporate lawyers, we mentioned that, draft the agreement, negotiate the agreement, at the very last minute they call somebody with experience in international arbitration and say, well, I need to define here the applicable law and the arbitration clause and the venue, et cetera, without lawyers with expertise in arbitration getting involved from day one in the definition of the applicable law, et cetera. Is that something that has changed to some extent? Or because what I see, in at least in Latin America, is that practice continues. And normally the issue is debated at the very last hour, and when the poor expert in international arbitration is asked the question, can I agree to Panamanian law? And then the response is, can I agree to Panamanian law in what context and what sort of contract? What are you talking about? Is that a practice that can say to be continuing in the practice of U.S. law firms and worldwide, or that has changed to some extent?
I would say it's getting a lot better. you know, the arbitration has now been around a long time. Corporate lawyers have a better sense of what it means and what it looks like. You know, they know that in a cross-border transaction, they're not going to automatically get their New York law clause and their New York courts clause. Some of them will still try. That it is going to be a negotiated point, and therefore they better have some sense of what, you know, the best forum and the best seat is. And so I find that, you know, we get the call earlier. There's more of a substantive conversation about it. Both parties are actually more sophisticated about asking for what they want in those clauses. And, you know, it can still be a compromise point at the very end of a deal. I actually find this more and more often being another negotiated provision. And I always say, you know, among the corporate partners at Skadden, as soon as one of them has been through one of these disputes from a contract that they drafted, you know, their entire attitude has changed forever in terms of how important they think that those provisions are. And, you know, experienced lawyers will at some point in their career face a challenge to one of the contracts they drafted and have that fear of, you know, is the litigation clause going to get my client what it wants? And so I actually think we're improving. I don't know if it's as common in Latin America. I think you have more generalists that do a little bit of both. And so maybe they think they already know. Rather than consulting a specific arbitration lawyer. But in the U.S., I find that it's more and more talked about and more common to see it given some thought.
That's a relief. Ari?
I think my experience is similar. You know, we've done a lot of things at Cleary to try to, and I see this across the kind of the industry, to try to front load that conversation a little bit, which includes, you know, kind of speaking with our corporate colleagues, not in the context of any particular deal, but trying to familiarize themselves with the importance of these clauses, circulating, you know, forms internally with model clauses and options for different clauses that also emphasize the importance of making this decision early on. That doesn't mean, you know, that there are no fire drills. You know, oftentimes you'll start out, the issue I think gets raised earlier now, and parties will talk about it, but it is oftentimes one of the last issues that I see being resolved. And so as Jennifer mentioned, sometimes it is, you know, something that's open for discussion and compromise, even at the very end of the deal. But at the very least, I do think the issues are being raised earlier on, even if they're not resolved earlier on.
Okay, no, thank you, Ari. Thank you, Jennifer. This has been a very enlightening conversation, and I hope our friends who are in the chat have learned something from the experience that we've had in this Frankenstein agreements and the problems that arise when you try to combine the needs of the client with the drafting of a contract plus the applicable law that is decided sometimes, as we said, in very last minute. So I give the floor to Rica. I think I see one more question here. In several cases decided by the New York courts, the application of force majeure has been rejected because the force majeure clause did not expressly exclude certain type of events, while in Latin American jurisdictions, general language has been accepted as sufficient basis to accept events not included in the contract. So the question is, do you consider that New York courts will follow a narrow application and reject claims in these cases, or do you think that there is any alternative to raise this defense, for example, via a catch-all provision in the contract? Well, I think we kind of went into that before in the difference between what the courts will react. But I don't know if any of you want to briefly comment on that particular question.
And I guess I'll just say that we're in a whole new world in terms of the frequency with which these issues are now coming up. And so I do think that we're still seeing how the law is going to play out on this subject. I think in general, it is safe to assume that a narrow application will be followed and that the language of the contract will prevail. But force majeure has typically been linked to this, you know, acts of God idea. That was the theory. And some people say this pandemic is an act of God, right? What else is it if not that? And so there is an argument that even if parties did not specifically include pandemics, that it's silly to not believe that a force majeure provision wasn't intended to include something like that. So I do think there's room for argument. This is one of those watershed events in history that will change the law in this area and will expand it. And certainly creative lawyers should try to make any arguments they can that will support their case. But in general, you know, New York courts try to follow the language of the contract, so that should always be your starting point.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer, very much. Thank you again very much, Jennifer, Ari. Rika, the floor is yours. Thank you very much to all of those who attended this meeting.
Thanks so much, Eduardo, to you as well, to our co-sponsors. It's really been a pleasure to talk through Dispelling Myths with you, and also thanks to our delegates, not only for joining in, but posing your questions in the chat. Stay tuned for more on this with regards to dispelling myths. We'll be back to you shortly. But with that, stay safe and well, and talk to you again soon. Thank you.